From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the auto industry tries to hold on to a precarious perch in this economic moment.
These companies hemorrhage money when they are not operating. So it is very important for them to continue to operate their plants, and we should take it as a good sign that they're adding shifts.
Also, how foundations take on the work of making sure that art is available to everyone.
We have to think about all of the factors that contribute to how people experience art, how they are able to access it, or what barriers there might be to that.
We're wrapping up a week of conversations about systemic racism in the arts, and we consider the body as an idea lab. Photographer Daryl D'Angelo Terrell talks about the alter ego featured in their lush, gender-bending self-portraits.
It's a way for me to pretty much be self-reflective, for me to really think about myself, and the way that I maneuver through space and through, like, the world.
First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what big funders and foundations can do to make sure that Michigan's arts groups are welcoming to everyone.
If they're not, you know, engaging with segments of the community and the population in meaningful ways versus sort of one-offs, then that's not going to gain any traction and real relationships aren't built.
More on that coming up later in the show. But first, this week's news cycle has been pretty short on good financial news. The U.S. economy plunged by a record-shattering 32.9% last quarter. There are still millions of people out of work because of the pandemic. But Daniel House has found that things could be worse for the auto industry. He's a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News, and he talks to us now and then about automotive news. Daniel House, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know at this point about how many of Michigan's assembly plants are online?
Oh, I think pretty much all of them are online. They need to get moving. They have been moving. GM has been increasing some shifts in some of its plants. I know in Fort Wayne, Indiana, it's truck plants. Wentzville, in Missouri, they had some issues. They were taking off a shift, then they added the shift back on. Ford seems to be running fairly consistently. We haven't really heard any issues there. FCA has had some concerns about COVID in the plants. They've been able to manage it and continue to move forward. You know, the UAW president has had to, from my understanding, has had to talk to some of their folks and say, you need to help me out here. You can't have people complaining about COVID issues in the plants and then going across the street to the union hall and hanging out without masks and drinking beers.
Right.
So, you know, it's that kind of thing. But I think in general, they're moving ahead and moving along. I did get an email after I wrote a column from a GM worker who said that, let's just say that there were some other things going on in the plants, but it's very hard to look at one source and make anything much out of it.
You know, I was taking a look at the news out of Mexico, and it looks like the coronavirus is still just really, really severe there. What kinds of supplier issues out of the country are the big three dealing with?
Well, there have been concerns coming right up to the restart that Mexico was going to be a problem. One of the things that General Motors said in its quarterly earnings calls yesterday was they think that the second half for them could be pretty darn good, that they could generate between $7 billion and $9 billion in cash, begin to pay down the $16 billion credit line that they opened when the pandemic began. But one of the things that they conditioned that on was that there's not supplier disruption. And that continues to be a concern. It's always a concern. It was a concern in China when China was exploding with COVID. And all the manufacturers pretty much managed to continue to maintain production because they have fail-safes and backup. They get sourcing on various components from two different geographic points. So if you have a problem in, say, China, you can get it from other Asian producers in other markets. And they have backups in North America as well.
Yeah, you know, a few weeks ago, Governor Whitmer was saying that she'd have to shut down the auto plants if people wouldn't wear their masks in public. I'm not exactly sure what the link was there. Can you tell whether that statement, you know, made any measurable difference? I was curious to know what the automakers thought of that, too.
Well, number one, I don't think you're going to see the automakers take on a governor publicly if they have issues. It doesn't benefit anybody. But I think privately, look, the reality is if these companies are not running their plants, they are losing enormous sums of money. I think you're going to see that Ford Motor Company is going to say that they've lost about $5 billion in the quarter. These are very large numbers, and You know, if these companies are not producing vehicles and their vehicles are not going out into the marketplace, you know, they could literally run out of cash. Ford says they have enough cash to get through 2020. Well, think about that. You know, we're more than halfway through the year. These companies hemorrhage money when they are not operating. So it is very important for them to continue to operate their plants, and we should take it as a good sign that they're adding shifts. Now, General Motors went into this pandemic down. They endured a strike. Their inventories were low. So this is an opportunity for them to run their lines to inflate their inventory around the country. But I think, you know, they believe that they can run efficiently and safely. I think they would say to the governor, we've got it handled here. Don't punish us because, you know, some people are out at the Jobby Nooner out, you know, on the east side of Detroit having a party in the boats.
Yeah, I saw that column that you published this week about GM's quarterly earnings from that period that was the extremely slowest part so far of the pandemic. What gears do you see Mary Barra finding during the downturn?
Well, I continue to be impressed with her decisiveness. She makes some hard-nosed decisions and is disciplined. I've covered General Motors all over the world since the mid-90s, so I've kind of seen the old GM up close. I've seen the new GM. And these guys are very nimble. They're hard-headed. They don't make all the right calls. They don't all make all the right product calls. I mean, I recently wrote about, you know, how the Ford Bronco has totally eclipsed anything that the GM did with their Chevy Blazer when they revived that. And I think they probably made the wrong call, and I think they recognize that. But, you know, that's one product. But in general, I think dealing with crises, she's very good and very decisive. And they only lost $800 million in the quarter, which is pretty remarkable.
What a sentence, Dan.
when you're talking about,
yes,
everything is in billions, right?
Right.
Everything
right.
is in billions. You know, you kind of come away going, wow. And you think, as long as you can keep operating, you're going to generate between $7 and $9 billion in cash in the second half of the year. That's pretty remarkable. And the other thing is that they'd cut salaries for, like, I don't know, 65,000-70,000 salaried workers, and they're rescinding those cuts for most people ahead of schedule, and they're going to pay them interest on top of the money that they owe them. So I think it's quite an interesting story. But the problem with General Motors is it's never enough in the marketplace. I mean, this news came out and the shares traded down. So then it becomes, well, what about your electrification strategy? How are you going to compete with Tesla? It's never enough.
Yeah. Well, and that is, I mean, it's so funny that we were hearing so much about electrification, and now it looks like that's one of the areas where sales have really slowed down. It's so weird. I feel like I was reading about a month ago that everybody ramping up production, and now it seems like everything's slow again except for used cars. Yes.
No, I think, you know, we're running at about I think they want to run 14 million units. That's another thing. I mean, used to be, but you get 14, 13 million annual selling rate. These companies are losing enormous amounts of money. Their break-even points are a lot lower now. So they're able to make money in a slower market, which is very encouraging. So we're not seeing the economic devastation, at least coming from the auto companies, that we would have in a similar environment 10 or 15 years ago.
In the meantime, it looks like you've been really busy in your copious leisure hours reading federal court filings from the UAW corruption case.
Mm-hmm.
That was a pretty eye-opening column that you published a couple weeks back. Could you lay out what you learned about the man who was essentially the money driving the scandal, Fiat Chrysler CEO Sergio Marchionne?
Oh, goodness. How much time do you have? my colleague Robert Snell and I have been after this story for 3 years, and it's pretty remarkable. You know, we did a piece at the end of last year called Driven by Greed. It basically lays out how this case had developed and come together, and it really started some of the corruption and the payments to UAW officials goes back to just the few weeks after Chrysler emerged from bankruptcy with federal money, and they began a process of essentially buying favor with union leaders. There is some allegations and is some evidence that Sergio Marchionne, who died a couple years ago, was part of this. He obviously was never charged. Don't know if he ever would have been charged, but ultimately the contention is that ultimately this was part of a strategy, at least that evolved, and ultimately he was trying to take over General Motors and to force a merger. And General Motors recently, some of your listeners may recall, filed a racketeering lawsuit against Fiat Chrysler, alleging that they had tried to corrupt the union to then force a merger with General Motors.
As you noted, I mean, this case under other circumstances might have been front page news for weeks. Why do you think it hasn't gotten more attention this summer?
Well, it has been front page news in the Detroit News.
Right.
We have covered this very aggressively, very consistently for probably 3 years. Rob has done a lot of groundbreaking work on this. I've worked with him on a lot of these things. We've had other of our auto writers who've been involved in it. I will tell you this. I have had conversations with members of national news organizations who have offices in Detroit who've commented on our work to us and said that they have tried to tell their bosses in New York, we need to cover this story, and the bosses in New York say nobody cares. So you have a national news media that is largely just kind of watched from the sidelines as we've done some of this work, but their folks in New York have kind of come to the conclusion that nobody cares about the UAW and corruption and who gives a rip. I find that to be exceedingly short-sighted. The United Auto Workers is a cornerstone of the modern American auto industry. It is an institution. It was very involved. Its leaders were very involved in the civil rights movement, particularly Walter Reuther. It has always been a leading organization in American labor, and it also had a reputation historically for being a, quote, clean union. It wasn't the Teamsters. It wasn't these other unions whose leaders had pilfered money, and it didn't behave. And for a long, long, long time, that was true, more or less. It's been in the last decade, under a succession, really two presidents in a row, that things badly got off the rails. And you had the Justice Department, through the U.S. Attorney, begin this investigation. It was initially, I believe, begun by Barbara McQuaid, who was nominated by President Obama, and then continued by Matthew Schneider.
On the upside, I'm looking forward to the book that the Detroit News staff is going to publish on this eventually. Dan, thank you so much.
You bet.
Daniel House of the Detroit News talks to us about the automotive industry. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We all have this version of ourselves who lives in our head, your favorite self, your strongest self, the self that this world, for whatever reason, does not want to let you be. For queer and gender non-binary artists, that self is not just a daydream. Detroit photographer and curator Daryl D'Angelo Terrell has been exploring identity and image and history through their work. Terrell was a 2019 Kresge Fellow who identifies as queer and femme and has been working on a particularly interesting series with a face they don't always show the world. We spoke with them earlier this year. Here's our conversation. You've been working on a photo series of self-portraits, but they're portraits of a very specific side of you, mm-hmm. an alter ego named Dion.
Mm-hmm.
Would you introduce us?
Oh, okay. Dion is a fat, black, femme, queer, non-binary identifying individual. Dion extends from my love and my admiration for all of the black femmes I grew up around on the east side of Detroit. So I pull influence from a lot of them, but also a lot of my like friends who are like in my close circle, but then also from like poetry and music and television and movies.
What do you feel Dion represents that you weren't expressing in other ways?
Oh, I mean, so I feel like a lot of my work, specifically when it's self-portrait, it's a way for me to pretty much be self-reflective, for me to really think about myself and the way that I maneuver through space and through, like, the world. And being that, okay, I am 6'7", 360 pounds. I am big. I, in this body, have had insecurities, right? Feelings that I'm not worthy of, to be desired, not feelings that I'm not worthy of love. Like, I'll be 29 this year and I've never been in a relationship, but I have friends who, like, are married with children and own homes, and I'm, all of these things were always in the back of my head. So I started thinking about how I can pretty much present or formulate a false identity or an alter ego that exhibited everything that I feel like I lack.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so came Dion, and Dion became this extremely high femme person because, again, I admire the girls from my hood, like the girls in the late 90s, early 2000s who have like the extremely long fingernails with the airbrush designs and the rhinestones on it, the girls who would go to the beauty supply to buy colored contacts, the girls who would buy all of this costume jewelry and cover their neck in it when I was in high school.
These photographs do not represent drag in a traditional sense, but Dion is confident and Dion is very glamorous.
Mm-hmm.
And these photos seem to be influenced by a whole range of images,
yeah,
from Robert Mapplethorpe's more austere self-portraits,
mm-hmm,
to the black velvet pop art images of black women that you've talked about seeing when you were a younger person.
Yeah.
Could you just talk about on an art direction level how you think through her looks in these photos?
Oh, definitely. So the first three diptychs are titled Untitled Dion Number 1, 2, and 3, or Sitting Pretty, or These Men Revolve Around Me. In this image, I found it to be important to purchase a peacock wicker chair. So, like, growing up, my mom, my auntie, other elders in my family, people in my community, they always had these photos of themselves and these peacock wicker chairs.
It's a staple.
It's a staple, definitely. And then, like, growing up and becoming really interested in just, like, black history and finding out who Huey P. Newton was and seeing this photo of him in the peacock wicker chair with the spear and the shield, right? And then back to the black velvet pop art paintings that I used to see at my Auntie Wanda's house of, like, this black woman sitting at a throne with two leopards at her feet. I think about that peacock wicker chair as, like, the African-American throne. It's like it's our way of honoring ourselves as king and queens, as royalty, as putting, like, it's a way for us to honor and cherish ourselves in ways that no one else outside of our race will and does.
I don't know if it's a case of the materials or, mm-hmm, just the posture. I mean, it's kind of impossible to slump in a peacock wicker chair.
Yeah, because you'll fall over.
Yeah, right?
I've done it.
It just lends this sort of regal attitude to the whole picture.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Just to switch gears a little bit, mm-hmm, could you tell us a little bit about where you work and how you work these days? Part of the reason I ask is, mm-hmm, that you received a Kresge Arts Fellowship,
yes,
last year.
Yes, true.
It's $25,000, and that is a big grant for a working artist.
Yeah, especially someone early in their career.
Yeah, but at the same time, when we think about $25,000 in terms of, like, you know, a salary, mm-hmm, it's not that much.
True, true.
So I just kind of wondered what it's like to try to put together the practical aspects,
yeah,
well, of your practice.
Thankfully, receiving the Kresge, I, like, purchased a lot of equipment. I commissioned a lot of people to help me with some photos that I have not yet, like, made public yet. So, like, I've gotten wigs customly made. I've had makeup artists actually do my makeup. I've purchased, like, new lenses, backdrops, things of that nature.
You mentioned that back when you were growing up, you weren't really making the scene in terms of nightlife.
Mm-mm. I felt uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, who's your community within Detroit right now?
That's interesting because I've been asking myself this question. So I feel like I have my friends, my close-knit friends, in which there are about 6 or 7 of them who I can go to and vent to and talk to and cry to and have conversations about art with. But then as far as, like, a wider community, I don't know. it's something I'm trying to restructure. But I do feel like I'm growing a community. I honestly just can't identify who they are.
Detroit's art scene feels so charged up.
Mm-hmm.
But would you say it still can be a challenging place for queer artists to find each other and to find work?
I won't say it's hard for us to find each other because once you find one, it pretty much becomes word of mouth, and we do, like, talk about each other. So now, as far as showing in Detroit as a queer artist, it works and then it doesn't work, right? So because my work currently with working with Dion, it is very visibly queer. Mm-hmm. I'm being tapped for all of the Pride exhibitions right now, which is bittersweet because I'm like, okay, so between, what, January and June, I don't really have anything planned. And then June hits and I have 4 exhibitions in 1 month. And I'm looking like, and all of them want the same work. And it's just like, okay, this is great. I'm happy that you're interested in my work. But I don't want to be that person who's only tapped locally when it comes to Pride events. Like, the work that I'm having is having a much wider conversation than just, like, here's gay work. Like, right. I'm having conversations about this intersectionality of what it means to be Black and queer. I'm having conversations about what it means to be a Black male-bodied person who is feminine and who exists within his feminine energy. I want to be seen for more than just, like, oh, the go-to gay artist for Pride Month. But outside of that, yeah, I mean, people, a lot of DIY spots I work through. If not showing art, I will, like, do a DJ set, or I would be the MC, or things of that nature. So there are ways for me to be present in Detroit.
Among the many, many things that you do, you started an Instagram account called the Museum of Contemporary Art IG.
Yes, Mocha IG.
And you use it to show work by people who are part of the African and Latinx diaspora.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a riff on Mocha as a museum of contemporary art only existing in the Instagram world.
Right, right.
It's so sad that this is an Instagram account and not a brick and mortar museum
yet. You know,
we're
going to speak this into existence.
Yes. Could you talk a little bit about how you curate that feed?
Yeah, definitely. So I went to grad school not only to become an artist, but to curate. This is something I've always been interested in. My mom, when I was in, I think I was in 10th grade, my mom took me to the DIA after they had finished remodeling. And this is when I first seen Glenn Ligon's To Disembark, which is this freight box in the African-American art, contemporary art space of the DIA. And it's a wooden freight box that plays Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. And this box is pretty much talking about Henry Box Brown, which was a slave who put himself in the freight box and shipped himself to freedom. And I remember my first time going into this specific gallery space in the museum, and it's that piece is in a corner. It's next to Alison Saar's Blood, Sweat, and Tears and a Betty Saar piece. And then across from it were like these two beautiful photos from James Van Der Zee. And then away from it was a painting by Robert Colescott. And I'm sitting in this space, and I'm like, what is going on? I was like, wow. Like, I think that was my first time having a strong emotional response to art. Like, actually sitting there and, like, tearing up. My mom is, like, sitting there talking to the security guard, and the security guard is talking to my mom about, like, things in the space. And then, like, I'm listening to them, but at the same time, I'm, like, really engulfed by Glenn Ligon's To Disembark. Mainly because, like, as a younger kid, I loved Billie Holiday. But seeing this piece and reading the literature that the museum had in front of it was really just like really effective for me. So in the back of my head, I always knew I wanted to curate. After graduating, I started applying for curatorial residencies and fellowships and jobs. And a lot of the times, the response was always, you don't have enough experience. Mm-hmm. So In the ages and days of social media, the best way to make experience is to make your own experience. So that's why I formed Mocha IG. Also because with my experience of like applying to a lot of these residencies, I was applying to like curatorial photography jobs when a lot of times they were using photography as just like a documentation of yesteryear and not using photography as an art form, which is stressing me out. So I was okay, I really want to be able to like formulate how contemporary African-American art and contemporary Latinx art is being produced at such a beautiful and high quality, and how this work needs to be seen.
Well, Daryl D'Angelo Terrell, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been a bruising summer for some of Detroit's best-known arts organizations. As we heard earlier this week, the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit and Detroit Institute of Art are both grappling with claims of racism leveled by current or former staff. We wanted to find out how some of the major funders in the arts see these issues. Priya Sarkar leads arts programming for the Knight Foundation. Based in Florida, it's made Metro Detroit a focus area, sending millions of dollars to artists and institutions. Priya Sarkar, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you say that foundations have an understanding of what artists and curators are talking about when they say that there are issues of systemic racism in the arts?
Yes, I would say that's true. I think that's the case for a few reasons. One, not only because it is, you know, part and parcel of us being able to do our mission correctly. You know, we're serving communities, and we have to think about all of the factors that contribute to how people experience art, how they are able to access it, or what barriers there might be to that, how people create art and have it shown or are able to share it with audiences. And so it's absolutely integral to what we're seeking to foster. And at the same time, I think another reason that folks think of that is because, at least in my experience, whether at Knight Foundation or even in speaking with other colleagues in the arts and cultural philanthropic community, so many of us have actually, been practitioners, you know, whether we were practicing artists or still are in some cases, or whether we have run organizations. So I think that, you know, just as individual people working in arts philanthropy, we kind of all bring our own experiences to that and have, you know, either come up against some of the challenges that our folks that we're trying to support now are also experiencing.
Now, you have a lens on this from having spent a lot of years as a working artist before getting involved in philanthropy. Can you maybe give us an example of something that is a more common practice in grant making right now to encourage that money gets into more diverse organizations that maybe wasn't really a thing when you were out there trying to get your own projects funded?
Sure. I would actually offer an example that has to do with not being an organization. So years ago, yes, I was a practicing artist and kind of doing, you know, working as a barista and also, you know, practicing art. And I think one thing that I saw at that time that was, gosh, probably 15 years ago, there wasn't a lot of philanthropic support available to individual artists. I think there still aren't a ton, but there are more, you know, nationally speaking. And one of the things that certainly Knight Foundation does and has done for many years is fund not only organizations, but also individual artists and collectives.
Why is that important to addressing systemic racism?
One is an issue of just how people organize and how they think about their work. Artists, you know, there are a lot of folks who are practicing and are doing it on their own or just in a group and don't necessarily either have the skills or expertise or just sort of the exposure to nonprofit as a sector. You know, what does it mean to be a 501c3 or have nonprofit tax status? You know, what does that entail? Do I need to organize in that? And, you know, certainly while there's a lot about, you know, the nonprofit sector and that setup that can be helpful in terms of being able to receive donations, et cetera, you know, it's not necessarily the end all be all in my own personal opinion of how you might want to organize if you're trying to create and share art or to engage communities through art. And I think a lot of folks, you know, across racial and ethnic, you know, and cultural and socioeconomic backgrounds, they're not necessarily going to immediately know or go to the idea of starting a nonprofit organization. So if you want to be able to truly support the breadth of the arts and cultural community in any city or any community, I think those support systems and the resources need to be there for individuals and collectives and folks who are just not necessarily going to be operating within the nonprofit kind of the system. And I think another piece of that is that for-profit is you know, a perfectly acceptable way to be an artist. You know, I think sometimes there can be a perception that, well, capital A fine art, or, you know, if you're engaging with audiences or communities and you're trying to help them experience art, that, you know, kind of a nonprofit organization is definitely the way to go. But for a lot of, you know, people, you know, it's important to be able to support yourself or partly support yourself through your creative work. And, you know, those folks shouldn't necessarily be penalized by not being able to also have access to, you know, resources to help them get going and help them get more traction with their work than nonprofit organizations.
Yeah, so those individual gifts kind of take some of the burden off of artists mm-hmm. who may not want to become a one-person institution
sure.
with nonprofit tax status and all.
Right.
Priya, there's been a lot of talk in recent weeks about what foundations can do to encourage accountability, ensure that arts groups are standing by the equity pledges that they're making in this moment. What are some of the ways that you see that working, maybe with funders holding feet to the fire or keeping on with the friendly pressure?
Sure. I think there are several ways that the philanthropic sector can do this. You know, one really kind of straightforward way is through the grants that we have with organizations or, you know, groups, collectives. You know, I think I'll just share that there is kind of a balance that philanthropic funders try to strike between making sure, of course, that the grant is successful and trying to help the grant to be successful, whatever it's for, whether it's a project or programming or general operations supporting that organization, and trying not to meddle too much in the operations of an organization. And that's certainly in recent weeks, we could say, been a topic of, I think, great discussion in just conversations that I've been part of, is how to do that properly. And so I think a really logical way to do it is through the lens of any particular grant you have, especially if you're, you know, mission is to serve a community, to serve the breadth of the community. You know, for Knight, we're certainly striving to support arts and culture that's truly reflective of the community. And part of being reflective of the community is truly looking at each community and the demographics of it, which always change, right? So if within the context of a particular grant, there are elements that seem like they need to be present for that grant to be successful and to achieve both the objectives of the grantee as well as the objectives of the funder. And, you know, presumably that's why the grant was made, is because there's alignment and synergy between those things. If there are questions or red flags that arise that kind of make us, you know, either wonder or be concerned whether the grant could be successful and carried out in the way envisioned, then I think, you know, that's an area where the funder can certainly have conversations, try to ensure that the grant is likely to be successful and that the right mix of factors is in place to make that happen. So one is through the lens of grants. Another one is by, you know, just kind of walking the talk ourselves, you know, striving to behave in the way that we also hope, you know, the folks who are implementing their programs and with the support of our dollars, you know, are doing. And, you know, I'll just kind of share an example of that through Knight Foundation is, you know, for several years, we have funded the Knight Arts Challenge. We've held the Knight Arts Challenge, which is an open call for arts and cultural projects. And we've done that in Detroit since 2013. So each year that we do the challenge, and we're doing it, you know, every other year now, we seek to kind of revisit the application process, make sure that, you know, the application itself is, you know, accessible and easily, you know, easily understandable for folks who are interested in applying. And the Night Arts Challenge itself was established as a way to be an easier kind of access to philanthropic funding than sort of a typical full-fledged grant application. So it's the first round application is a 150-word description of your idea. The idea being that, you know, great ideas can come from anywhere and anyone. And hopefully by having a simple first step, that is, you know, a way to more easily access philanthropic funding for that idea. And another thing that we do, and each year we try to do better at this, is in the outreach where we are offering this opportunity. So trying to do information sessions throughout Detroit, and I should say it's greater Detroit. It's Detroit, Hamtramck, Highland Park, and even out in Dearborn, yes, as well. So
within the metro area.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. And so really trying to, you know, in person, get out to various neighborhoods to share information about this opportunity. Doing, we call them coffee chats or coffee hours, but they're sort of one-on-one sessions also at different, usually it is a coffee shop or a bakery or some sort of local neighborhood hangout where hopefully we're literally physically more accessible to folks to come and kind of chat about their idea, give feedback on it, sometimes give feedback on the 150-word description, try to help make just help folks strengthen that application. And also by promoting the opportunity in multiple languages. So those are some of the things that we have done and we continue to try to do better at with each iteration of the Night Arts Challenge. So I think I consider that to be one of the ways we are trying to walk that talk. And finally, I think the third way is just by participating in the community. You know, philanthropic entities are also community members. So, you know, we participate with the community along with other sectors, you know, whether it's others, you know, civic leadership or civic organizations, you know, social service organizations, you know, educational organizations and just residents, to participate in, you know, shared objectives. And that's another way that we can help to, encourage change and accountability. We can hold each other accountable.
There are still people, I think, who you know, look at the art world and they say, look, so much of art is just based in this inherent old European style of looking at the world. So much of Western tradition comes from a colonialist point of view. The anointed masters are almost exclusively dead white guys, and that people of color often occupy little more than a position of ornamentation or portrayed as stereotypical within the canon that we see represented in major museums. You know, the contemporary art world is, you know, arguably a little different, but it's had its own problems with it. Mm-hmm. How do you think about the things that art has to say amid all its baggage and flaws and why it's still worthy of funding?
Oh, gosh. Well, I think what art has to say is kind of what we all have to say or what we each have to say. I think so many times we may find in art something expressed that we haven't found the words to describe ourselves, or we haven't even necessarily pinpointed that we were feeling until we may have, you know, seen it in a movie, seen it in a film, or heard it in a song, seen it, you know, on a canvas. I think that is one of the most powerful things that art can do, which is kind of help us to understand ourselves better as individuals, as well as, you know, communities, and help us understand each other. And I think that, you know, the thing that art does so well that, is maybe unique compared to understanding something through, you know, studying history or taking a course or something, is that it connects with people both intellectually and emotionally. And I think when you can do both of those things and not just one level or the other, it's incredibly more impactful. And so that's certainly why I, you know, am so thankful to be involved in the arts and to have the opportunity to help support that in communities.
We've seen a number of arts nonprofits that have been trying to seize the moment and have started to diversify staff or invited artists to collaborate. Mm-hmm. But as we see in the case of MOCAD in recent weeks, even positions that were funded with lofty ideals in mind don't always produce a desired effect. Do you have thoughts on why that approach may not work?
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, we've seen that even with other types of hires. I think that, you know, just hiring one person or one or two people to do something and kind of expecting, you know, them to carry a burden is not fair. Whether it's hiring people of color in certain roles or even hiring folks to do certain functions. Sometimes it might be to hire them to develop technology, you know, in that organization. And Knight has had some experience with this too. If it's just one or two people and the sort of support network within the organization isn't there, and the resources aren't there to support that work at a high level, it's just far less likely to succeed. And also, I think because especially with regard to hiring people of color in particular roles, it is about the resources. You know, it's the difference to me anyway. It's the difference between, you know, having diversity on staff and actually having equity. You know, how are those people supported? You know, are they supported in meaningful ways? I think it's a similar issue to when organizations kind of have tokenistic programming. You know, if they're not, you know, engaging with members of the community and, you know, segments of the community and the population in meaningful ways versus sort of one-offs, then that's not going to gain any traction and real relationships aren't built. So I think that with any kind of work, if you are going to really make meaningful progress and gain traction, then there has to be a whole host of things in place, such as, you know, multiple people who are devoted to it, a true, you know, institutional commitment and culture that supports it. You know, the everyday little things that happen, for example, in a workplace that also kind of contribute to those things moving forward. All of those have to be in place to actually make progress.
You know, some of the folks that we've talked to on this topic have suggested that maybe part of the problem is our expectations for how art is funded right now. That if institutions were willing to work with a wider circle of donors, maybe making smaller gifts, that there might be more accountability to the community and maybe a better hope of more equity within the organizations that bring us the arts. Do you think that might change? I mean, you work with organizations ranging from individual artists to really large museums and institutions. Mm-hmm. How do you think that might change what we have in our communities right now?
I think it's a fascinating question. We kind of have been seeing that for a while now in the American political landscape too, right? With sort of crowdfunding and, you know, certain candidates committing to, you know, raising their funds through small donations from more people and sort of declining, you know, contributions from, say, super PACs or what have you. So I think it's interesting because it's one of the reasons it's interesting is it's a broader conversation than just arts and culture. I think that certainly when you diversify funding sources, you also diversify accountability, and that can be a really good thing, especially if you're an organization or an artist who is working in service of community. The more kind of stake that more aspects of a community or people in a community have in your work, the more opportunity there is for, you know, mutual accountability. I think that can be a really good thing. I think that sometimes that can exist, that idea can exist in some tension with, say, artistic vision or curatorial vision, if the, you know, if the approach is not as much a community engaged kind of approach. Another thing I think that has been really, really interesting to sort of see play out this year with the pandemic is how that diversification has actually, what that has meant with the impact of the pandemic. So, for example, Knight for quite some time since, you know, before I got to Knight, has really encouraged grantees to diversify funding sources, you know, to not be heavily reliant on us or even on philanthropy in general, to really encourage, you know, earned revenue as part of the mix of funding resources.
That would be things like ticket sales.
Yeah, exactly. It could be ticket sales. I mean, it could be merchandise, you know, selling t-shirts at your show. It could be a lot of things. And just to try to have more of a mix in funding resources. And so what's been interesting with the pandemic, some of the folks, a lot of the folks, organizations who have been hardest hit, were those who had done that. Because we couldn't have shows, you know, because museums had to close and people weren't, you know, able to come and pay that admission fee. For those organizations who had in fact become less reliant on philanthropy, that they took the bigger hit. And so that has certainly been part of our conversations, and really, I wouldn't say we've arrived at any answers around that, but it's, you know, part of a conversation we've been having, you know, within Knight Foundation, as well as, you know, with organizations we support, is just, you know, kind of this eye-opening experience where it was just sort of this wake-up call to, okay, something that I think for quite a while in arts and culture had been a bit of a holy grail, which is to become less reliant on philanthropy and have more earned revenue, ended up backfiring a bit in the current moment. Do I think that that's, you know, a long-term thing that we want to move away from earned revenue as a significant part of the income mix? I don't think so. But I do think it certainly warrants a reexamination of how we think about getting to sustainability.
Priya Sarkar is director of the Knight Foundation's arts program. Priya, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the conversation.
That's Stateside for today. In the coming week on the show, primary elections and challenges to voting during the COVID era. Former Governor Bill Milliken is memorialized in northern Michigan. And we'll have a conversation with Michigan's new Teacher of the Year. Those stories and more are all coming up when we're back with you next week. We hope you can join us. Our show is produced by Mike Blank and April Van Buren, with help from our interns, Leah Baldori, Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovitt, and Olive Scott. Our director is Mercedes Mejia. The executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you next week.